I thank the Laura Ingalls Wilder Committee that honors my work with this award, and I also thank the bigger organization of the Children's Services Division of the American Library Association. What a mouthful to describe a collection of many dear old friends and associates, and some sprightly new ones. I am grateful that I have met so many of you on your own turf across the country. If we have anything left in our glasses, we might raise them with the toast of a friend to those who are here and those who are not. Surely some splinter of light suggests Fred Melcher's smile. Some voice deeper and more resonant than most echoes Anne Carol Moore's grunt of satisfaction. Memories swirl around us tonight. Traditionally, this evening was not so much an occasion to toss halos or pat backs or keep score, but a coming together of all of us united in the pride and pleasure of what we all do as well as we can, bring children and books together. Solemnity got chased out of the room by celebration and laughter, and some felt themselves rise like yeasty bread, and young people were fired to make not books, but books. I thank my publishers, especially Scribner's, who helped and encouraged and tried not to step on me. Charles Scribner and I have been meeting like this off and on for almost 50 years. Also Ursula Nordstrom, who gave me my first chance, unfulfilled, to illustrate before we knew each other well enough to find out how we might have worked together. Margaret McElderry rescued my dejected goats and enabled them to find their green hills and grow fat in Japan, and opened up a whole association of friendship for me. The honesty and support of my dear friend and editor, Janet Laranger, have been invaluable to me. I could depend on thoughtful frankness, even if it stung. But it is not only the editors, it's the designers, the loyal, precious ones in publicity, like Beeman Lord, Maureen Hayes, who without being one understood what it took to try to be an author, and those who paved waves of welcome by their own warmth, dependability, and imagination. I owe so much to all of you. To you librarians, I probably owe most of all. You have enabled my work to live as long as it has. If one lasts long enough, it seems that all one's interests come around full circle. Illustration draws on them all. Ballet, travel, music, storytelling, they all come together in the books. And let's not leave out daydreaming, even if it means a permanent dent in the head and two battered cars along the way. Many of my books started with my pleasure in the story hours and picture book hours in the public libraries of New York. The pictures were big, so that many children could see them. The books were individually different, one from the other, so that I, and eventually the children, would not be bored. Mistrust of any closure into a self-imposed style seemed necessary for growth. Absolute certainty was not a problem. Doubt preceded the exploration essential to liberation. Doubt is a constant and helpful companion to many of us. Paths that might have seemed possible once were not taken. We can all probably poke around in our own underbrush and find traces of old starts, old trails that got lost, and even some old wallows. When Margaret Fontaine was asked to explain what she had communicated in a ballet, she answered, "I explained it while I was doing it." The same might often be said about books. My sisters and I grew up in various small towns in New York State, which we had been told was the best of all possible states. Upper New York State cannot claim to be in the Middle West, but in its relaxed casualness, it certainly has little to do with the more disciplined, more conservative, and traditional New England where I now live. A quick drive over the border will tell you that. Bicycles get left in the yards. Muddy shoes get left on the porches. Sometimes old cars don't get carted off and rest in their tracks. The Dutch, along with their vaporing little city, have bequeathed an earthiness in the enjoyment of the flowers and fruits of the earth and of each other. It's all there in their paintings. In the Hudson Valley, they built to last their handsome old farmhouses of tawny and gray field stones, solid and sturdy as the barns of the Pennsylvania Germans. In the early 20s, country people came to my father's church in Cooperstown in middle New York State in surreys and buggies. Winters were serious affairs. Often looking out the front windows, we could see hats walking along on the snow. We built igloos with crusty blocks of ice that would last for weeks. Farmers came into town in heavy open bobsleds that children hitched their own small sleds to the consternation of their parents. Trim horses a-jangle with bells drew elegant little cutters. Since we can't choose which span of time life allots us, we're lucky if it stretches from the late teens and the tag ends of a former century toward the approach of a new one. We're lucky if we find life still expanding after many years. I have a confession. Although I had given Mrs. Wilder's books out to library children, I'd never read them until this last winter. And so I read them, all but one, and rediscovered backwards much of my own childhood. Being told as stories, Mrs. Wilder's books are almost guides to frontier living. How to build a log cabin, how to cook from food at hand, how to raise livestock. Almost always, there was music and singing in the evening after the chores were done. Laura's father could do anything, hunt, trap, build, farm, and any night, play the violin. We seem to hear our own grandmothers telling us in graphic detail of their childhoods. No matter that some names are carved in the walls of Ellis Island, or that some came ill and crowded most cruelly in dark frigates, or that some came to wilderness and found a land and people quite new, or that some were those people watching, with misgiving the others arrive. Mrs. Wilder has given us not only an autobiography, a testament to ingenuity, courage, and optimism, but also a map to a life. Here in the deep woods near Lake Pippin, Wisconsin, she began life and her story. Pa hunted, raised wheat. In the evenings after work, he played his fiddle and the family sang. Then, still longing for unconfining space, Pa made a covered wagon and the family set out for Kansas, Indian land, until the Indians packed up their tents and poles and left for land farther west. The family pulled up its new roots after only a year and moved on too. Another family that had lost their horses to thieves refused to leave their wagon. Pa drove on, leaving them sitting on the wagon tongue, all alone on the prairie. Pa muttered to himself, "Tenderfeet. Everything they own and no dog to watch it. Didn't keep watch himself and tied his horses with ropes." Pa snorted. Shouldn't be allowed west of the Mississippi. Here was the sod house nestled into the bank of Plum Creek. Here was the homestead near De Smet, Dakota Territory, where the stories of Laura and Almanzo of the ancient and beautiful name began to blend and finally join in happiness that was golden. The treks on the Middle Western map continue into the Ozarks to Mansfield, Missouri. Laura Ingalls told Almanzo Wilder that she didn't want to be a farmer's wife. She became one, a splendid one, evidently. When Almanzo had a stroke from getting up too soon from a bout with diphtheria, Laura raised chickens, sold eggs, added to the farm acreage. Look into the eyes in those old photographs and see some of the story. Rose Wilder Lane describes her parents having just located the site for their Ozark home. My father was glowing and my mother shining. William Leastheat Moon's Prairie Earth is about Chase County in Kansas. Walked over, run over, crisscrossed, probed, the only place in Kansas where the 8-foot-high blue-stem prairie grass still grows. To hear about it is one thing. To try to imagine men and animals making their way through it, hiding in it, racing from fires in it, is quite another. Chase County, Kansas, is where the wind people dwelt. Their totem was the wind. The name Kansas comes from a Siouan dialect word meaning wind people. Chase is a sun radiating questions and ruminations about the past. Leastheat Moon intersperses his ruminations about Chase County with provocative quotes. From his commonplace book, which is anything but, I pass along to you some jottings. You must not be in the prairie, but the prairie must be in you. He who tells the prairie mystery must wear the prairie in his heart. That from William Quayle in The Prairie and the Sea, 1905. No one, I discover, begins to know the real geographic, democratic, indissoluble American Union in the present or suspect it in the future until he explores these central states and dwells a while on their prairies or amid their busy towns. Walt Whitman in Specimen Days. As I write at my desk, I finger a piece of flint from the Flint Hills of Chase County. Without being a student of geology, I love rocks, crystals, and bits of mineral picked up on my travels. They're nuggets of mystery. What to take? Let your trunk, if you have to buy one, be of moderate size and the strongest make. Test it by throwing it from the top of a three-storied house. If you pick it up uninjured, it will do to go to Kansas, not otherwise. James Redpath and Richard Hinton in Handbook to Kansas Territory. In his book, Mountain Light, In Search of the Dynamic Landscape, the brilliant photographer Galen Rowell finds the most interesting parts of the natural world are the edges, places where ocean meets land, meadow meets forest, timberline touches the heights. Near the end of the day, transmitted light becomes ever warmer, reflected light ever cooler. Janet Laranger and I now have two bases, both practically at opposite edges of this land. Usually we take the time to drive between them because we delight in the landscape changing and the accents changing and the light on the changing contours. We often vary our route, sometimes following blue highways, sometimes red. Robert Penn Warren wrote, "What is love? One name for it is knowledge. In order to hold a memory, you have to give it something of yourself, sketches of thrusts, directions, long lines relaxing, curves meeting straights, color notes. These help. Photographs help. Maps help. Encounters, perforce brief, with people along the way help. Many of you have wandered with Steinbeck and Charlie, with Edwin Way Teal, with William Leastheat Moon, the smaller roads blue on the state maps. Maps are a way of organizing wonder, Peter Steinhardt wrote in Names on a Map. A dear friend's mother traveled from Wichita, Kansas to Abilene, Texas and back in a covered wagon drawn by oxen. Eventually, she settled and raised her family in Enterprise, Kansas. Enterprise could have been the family name, but it was Corcoran. Place names in America can tell where people came from, places they were homesick for, places they yearned toward. Names tell what they did, how they felt about it. Often physical grandeur overwhelmed them, and the only names that sufficed were those associated with the exaltation the Bible offered. Spirit stretched to extremes. Zion, Mount Olympus, Paradise, Eden, Bethel. Soddy Daisy and Bull Snort are bound to be different. In high school, we read Rolvag's Giants in the Earth and heard the sigh of the endless grasses bending to the winds. Tisha. My Aunt Ania gave us the feeling of the prairie as deeply ingrained in people who grew up there as the high moors in Yorkshire were to Kathy and Heathcliff. Long ago, before I even knew anyone from the real Middle West, I envisioned it as space with long, long straight lines. The sky was a great round bowl over a flat pie of earth. Willa Cather helped. He felt that men were too weak to make any mark here, that the land wanted to be let alone, to preserve its own fierce strength, its peculiar savage kind of beauty, its uninterrupted mournfulness. That from O Pioneers. And from Little House on the Prairie, Laura knew what he meant, that the prairie would never seem crowded. She liked this place, too. She liked the enormous sky and the winds and the land that you couldn't see to the end of. Everything was so fresh and clean, and big and splendid. Why do we enjoy farmers' museums and their displays of old tools, harnesses, farm wagons? Details of everyday living make up much of the wonder and pleasure of existence. Laura Wilder gives such vivid descriptions of her mother's simple, sturdy meals they could serve as recipes. There was stewed jackrabbit with white flour dumplings and plenty of gravy. There was a steaming hot thick cornbread flavored with bacon fat. There was molasses to eat on the cornbread, but because this was a company supper, they did not sweeten their coffee with molasses. Ma brought out the little paper sack of pale brown store sugar from Little House on the Prairie. Before Laura wrote the Little House books, she had written articles for farm journals and some national magazines. Published last year as Little House in the Ozarks, they tell of Rocky Ridge Farm, of a point of view about happiness, you make it, or family life, sharing among neighbors, the need for women to have the vote. Mrs. Wilder, who hadn't wanted to be a farmer's wife, realized that she could feel both independence and satisfaction, knowing her work on the farm was fully as important as her husband's. 8 years before the 19th Amendment was passed, women in Kansas were given the vote. Optimism comes so often from believing that one's inner strengths are equal to the tasks ahead. Knowledge and experience breed the confidence, astonishing to us, that those settlers had in tackling their jobs, raising morgans, constructing chimneys, raising sheep, carrying through the process of shearing the wool, spinning, weaving, sewing, until the garment was made. They became extremely ingenious in solving problems. There were so many to be solved. The private, self-sufficient life of the immediate family was important, but so was helping one's neighbors harvest a crop, raise a roof, build a road, even join in a kind of recreation and change of pace in the Friday evening literaries. Compressed in recounting, the perils of prairie existence cause even Pauline's to pale. The prairies only seem calm in their softly rolling rhythms. Grass fires could sweep away crops, a year's toil in an afternoon. Searing winds of such violence that a 9-year-old on a horse sailed like a leaf into the sky and eventually came to earth stark naked and steedless, but unharmed. Bursts of wild flowers in the spring like rockets in a green sky. Blizzards so dense and long-lasting that only a rope strung between house and barn enabled a farmer to find his way to his stock. Mrs. Wilder, like Thomas Hardy, had such an eye for the details of nature, such an ear for the sounds that one hears the tiny rustles of field mice in the grasses, the soft brush of first snowflakes. Her first book ends with the child Laura's awareness that this is now, not to be forgotten. Art critics who haunt museums and cities are sometimes very patronizing to artists whose visions escape them, or quite simply who have had different experiences from their own. To describe the huge rhapsodic landscapes of Albert Bierstadt and Frederick Church as extravagant fantasies means the writer had probably never seen the Grand Canyon over 50 years ago, before tourism hobbled its wild edges. Could he have seen the ever-changing light and blue veils of rainstorms now concealing, now revealing the astonishing contours? He'd probably never come off the heights of Mesa Verde after thunderstorms in late afternoon, with sun shafts picking out one detail after another from the racing cloud shadows. Rich the personal map that has registered such sights. Now, my personal map takes in all the states of the Union except Alaska and many countries of the world. A question exists for all seasons. I am in the season that asks, how do you feel about how you've spent your life? Like another Brown, we ask naively, how can we lose when we're so sincere? Well, we can, alas. In a letter to Salman Rushdie, published last spring in the Los Angeles Times, Carlos Fuentes, the Mexican novelist, wrote of the great joy of the future, the meeting with the other, with the man and woman of the other faith, another race, another culture, who are not like you and me, but who complete and reveal who you and I truly are. We need the stranger in order to know ourselves. You tell us that no one by themselves can see the totality of reality, and that we are only unique because others exist along with us, different from us, but occupying with us the time and space of the world. After a lifetime of dreaming about the Middle Kingdom, I finally, in 1979, added China to my personal map, and life has not been the same since. I've returned twice to study, to travel, and to learn techniques so ancient they seem modern. Associating with artists who understood what I was trying to do because they were trying too, although they had a whole history ahead of me, I felt a tremendous surge of inner freedom and vitality. What do freestyle Chinese painting or Chinese calligraphy have to do with picture books? A good deal. Here's a road without end to challenge, to reveal a way to use a part of oneself only occasionally expressed. For years, I had imagined working in an art in which all preparation, all labor, all study preceded finally putting brush to paper. That was a moment for speed, for directness, like very fast, almost extravagant handwriting, revealing one's feeling, conveying above all intensity and life. This is an ideal. We all know performance often falls short of our ideals, but without ideals, it falls shorter yet. Once in a while in my books, I may have managed to do it. On absorbent Shren paper in my studio, I'm sometimes able to express spirit more often in free landscapes and in running style calligraphy that is alive on the paper. Intuitively, the onlooker enters the feeling of the brush's dance, feels the opposites always implied there that make up the map of the work. He grasps the power of strength, he grasps the power of quiet. I felt that little children not yet corrupted by the visual junk poured out to them might respond to such work. It might be close to the elastic fluctuations of their own energy. Tiny children universally stretch out their arms to embrace the huge shining sea. Dancers and their arabesques trace the ancient rhythms of calligraphy. The heart sets the beat for a great deal of music. Compass grass grows on Cape Cod dunes and on the dunes at the base of eroded mountains in the west. Pushed by the wind, it traces its circles in the sand. In Nebraska, in the Dakotas, you can see the ruts of old wagon trails. Old tracks may not be the ones we can easily follow now. We don't see in the same way we did. But we are aware of devastation when we come upon it. At the edges of this landmass, America, it's often popular to be patronizing about Middle America. Yet the solidity of character, the stable sense of values, the courage, the ingenuity that Laura Ingalls Wilder describes in her books, to say nothing of cohesive family life, endure in the best of America. In our opera houses, we thrill to voices that first sang in church choirs in Midwestern towns. Most of the first desk flute players in our leading symphony orchestras are students of Robert Willoughby, who was an Iowa farm boy. Publishers' lists are peppered Cajun style with Midwestern writers. What are the constants? For one, perhaps space. The yearning for fulfillment that space, sea, or sky, or prairie engenders. Who knows? But the record tells. Now space is shrinking. Years ago, many of the summer hills of California were like furry elephant babies with hairs blowing in the wind. Now the contours have been bulldozed to conform to developments. One sees a sea not of water, but of roofs. The irony is that greed did not pay off, and beneath the roofs are empty houses, but the hills are forever gone. Time seems to heal, but it also buries. Will there be anyone left to dig to find our Troys? Who will sing of leaders aimless as grasses who want the perks of leadership but don't know how to lead? How long do we go on watching a wonderful country, an extraordinary experiment, an amalgamation of talents and nationalities, fall apart? Respect for other races and hands extended in welcome are withdrawn in hostility and mistrust. Droves of wistful, unhappy children without security of love or home grow into violent gangs, seeking the identity and support they never had. Infants die at a rate shocking in a country with our technology. Many young people are barely articulate, let alone literate. People are frozen out of their homes by loss of savings. AIDS sucks away lives. Many of them are most gifted. Where are we? We seem to have lost our map. We can't jump off the edges. The world is round. Books like Mrs. Wilder's are like a flashlight in the black bowl of a prairie night. They light at least the one step that has to follow another. Someone has to take those steps toward assuming full responsibility for the beginning lives of children. I would like to conclude this grateful ramble with a poignant poem of William Stafford that I came upon recently. It can be interpreted in many ways. It's called Going On. On the hollow night, a small hand taps just once. It is our child, whose eyes reflected me, a tiny mote, but in those eyes, a giant man. A heart beats, and all the world surges in my breast. Then, the stillest way a hand can be and still be, it lies there in mine. Easy world, you gave it once. Please quietly welcome it back, that hand.